Hello, everybody. It's a Red Star Radio interview for you today. And if you've been following the imperialist press in the Western nations, as some of us have to, you will have seen a number of, frankly, hysterical articles burst forth over the last few weeks regarding a speech given by Comrade Kim Jong-un at the meeting of the Supreme People's Assembly of the DPRK, in which he outlined the policies that the DPRK government will be pursuing with regards to relations with what's known as the Republic of Korea or South Korea. But you will probably hear myself and my interviewee today refer to it as perhaps the Occupied South. And to counteract the propaganda and the hysterical fear-mongering that comes from the British bourgeois press, I have with me today Dr. Dermot Hudson of the Korean Friendship Association. He's been on the show a couple of times before, but I thought it was an opportune moment to invite Dermot back to discuss this. So, Dermot Hudson, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's great to be back.
Now, Dermot, I want to start with the way in which this speech by Kim Jong-un has been covered and the reality of what he said and what the policy of the DPRK is towards the occupied South. Now, in this speech, Kim Jong-un outlines the fact that there needs to be a change in the policy towards the occupied South, in stating that there has been an attempt by the government of the DPRK to build more positive relations with the occupied South over many years, and that it is the view of the government of the DPRK now that this is an attempt that has failed, and that the Republic of Korea under its current leadership is to be viewed as a state which is essentially unremittingly hostile. I wondered if you could comment on that and also then elaborate on the way in which the policy has changed over the last few decades and the fact that the DPRK government has been pushing for better relations, but this has been thwarted by both the government in Seoul and probably the US imperialists behind them.
Right. Okay. Yeah, first of all, I don't recognize the regime in Seoul as a government. It is a totally a puppet state.
Yes.
It's an entity created by US imperialism. As you rightly say, it's the occupied South. Now, to fully understand the significance of the speech made by respected comrade Kim Jong-un at the recent session of the Supreme People's Assembly, you need to look at the decisions and the speech that he made at the ninth plenum of the 8th Central Committee of the Workers' Party of Korea, which was held at the end of last year, from the 26th of December onwards until the end of the year, at which he laid down policies for dealing with the occupied South in the future. But essentially, it was these policies that were agreed at the ninth plenum that were laid down, you know, their implementation, I should say, was laid down at the Supreme People's Assembly session. But basically, it was to look at the legal side of, you know, the implications of the new policy. And what Marshal Kim Jong-un said in December with regards to the South, he said, and I quote, "South Korea at present is nothing but a hemiplegic malformation and colonial subordinate state whose politics is completely out of order, the whole society tainted by Yankee culture, defense and security totally dependent on the US." And I think that sums up South Korea very quite well. And basic basically the ninth plenum and the 10th session of the 14th Supreme People's Assembly of the DPRK sort of came to the conclusion that it's no longer possible to deal with South Korea, to regard, you know, South Korea as compatriots or fellow countrymen, that South Korea is in fact a hostile state, and the Supreme People's Assembly basically defined South Korea as the number one enemy of the DPRK. And, you know, a number of decisions were taken, you know, such as revising the constitution of the DPRK as such to define South Korea as a hostile state, to basically legally define the southern borders of the DPRK and to reject the so-called northern limit line in the West Sea. Now, that is a very important point that I think people should bear in mind, because the West Sea of Korea has long been a zone of confrontation between the DPRK and South Korea, because South Korea insisted on an illegal boundary in the sea that is not recognized in international law, was not recognized in the Korean Armistice Agreement. It was sort of something that South Korea unilaterally decided. And, you know, there's been several quite severe armed clashes in that area, particularly in 2002 and also 2010. So the DPRK is rejecting that, you know, the so-called northern limit line. So, you know, that might generate some kind of clash this year or in the future. So there's going to be a lot of tension. And, you know, significantly, decision was made to demolish or remove the monument to the free charters of national reunification, which I think many of people listening to this podcast who visited Pyongyang will be familiar with. And, you know, it's something that you would have seen on pictures. And, you know, I think this is very symbolic that they're doing this. But sort of coming to your point about the history of the DPRK's alliance and policies towards the South, the demolition of the monument, you know, fully reflects the conclusion made by the DPRK that, you know, you can't peacefully reunify with the capitalist South. This is not possible, and the DPRK's experience has proved this. And you know, it goes back a very long way. Back in 1972, in July 1972, on the 4th of July 1972, the director of the South Korean Central Intelligence Agency, yes, South Korea named their security services after the US one, being typical puppets. He visited Pyongyang, met President Kim Il-sung, and a North-South joint statement was agreed, which stated that Korea should be reunified on the basis of the three principles of independence, peace, and great national unity. And there was the idea of the Confederal Republic that was outlined in detail at the 6th Congress of the Workers' Party of Korea in 1980. And the idea of that was a sort of two systems, one country approach, where you'd have a reunified Confederal Korea with a socialist North and a capitalist South. And after that, there were agreements on inter-Korean reconciliation in 1991, and of course the historic June the 15th summit of 2000, and later summits in 2007-2018, and basically at the sort of scenario where you had these summits, you know, handshakes, agreements, but nothing really changed. And I can speak from experience, because I've actually visited Panmunjom, which is the historic place where the Korean Armistice Agreement of 1953 was signed. It's a symbol of confrontation between the DPRK and the occupied South and the US. And I visited it in August 2017 when the tensions were very, very high indeed. And when Trump was talking about fire and fury, etc. And later, in October 2019, I visited it again. Now, between those two visits, you had three inter-Korean summits, two DPRK-US summits, and an agreement on, you know, an inter-Korean military agreement had been signed. No, difference compared to 2017. You know, it was the same, the tensions were still there. So I think that proves, you know, through my own eyes that, you know, these agreements were useless. And essentially, I think two points I'm going to conclude on was essentially the different puppet regimes in the South had no intention of trying to reunify on equal terms or of recognizing the DPRK socialist system. They wanted to actually destroy it. They wanted to overthrow the socialist system in the DPRK and basically annex the DPRK, a bit like what West Germany did to the GDR at the end of the 1980s. That was always the South Korean puppet's intention. And I remember back in 2018, when there was sort of, you know, several inter-Korean summits, the South Korean puppets were boasting that there would be a McDonald's and KFC opened in Pyongyang, and the DPRK would join the IMF. And of course, that betrayed their real intention, but it didn't happen. So by sort of taking this new harder line against South Korea, Comrade Kim Jong-un is actually rejecting regime change. He is defending the socialist system of the DPRK, and he's showing the DPRK's commitment to socialism. Of course, there's people who won't like that at all. You know, there were a lot of liberals, even some fake friends of the DPRK, who were very keen for the DPRK to open up to South Korea. And I think my last point is, you know, whatever South Korean puppet regime has been in power, because you've had some liberal ones, as well as the more recognizable fascist or conservative far-right regimes. You've had liberal regimes like Kim Dae-jung, like Moon Jae-in. But their approach has always been the same. They've always been puppets of the US. None of the so-called liberal rulers of South Korea attempted to end the US occupation of South Korea. None of them abolished the national security law, a very repressive anti-communist law, very McCarthyite. They didn't change that. And their intention was always to destroy socialism in the North, whether by force or through the so-called sunshine policy, you know, the which is based on the old fable of the wind and the sun trying to make a man take off his coat, and the idea that they could blow capitalism into the DPRK through offering in endorsement inducements and incentives for the DPRK to reform and open up.
Well, just to return to the question of the constitutional points here, the constitution of the occupied South, I believe, essentially, actually, much like the original constitution of the old West Germany, doesn't actually recognise the borders of the DPRK at all, does it? It doesn't. Don't they lay claim to the entirety of the Korean Peninsula in their constitution?
That's correct. That is absolutely correct. They've never never recognised the DPRK, and in the national security law, which I mentioned earlier before, the DPRK is defined as an anti-state entity. That's how they define the DPRK. So, you know, reunification with South Korea is really impossible, and the DPRK has basically recognised this fact.
Yes, and as you said in your original answer, there's been almost 50 years of attempts at negotiation going all the way back to the early 1970s between the DPRK and the occupied South. And every time the DPRK tries to engage in some kind of agreement, it leads to either nothing or an actual escalation of hostility. So it's clear that the US imperialist puppet masters who stand behind the occupied South, they and their puppets will only accept complete capitulation and surrender and the destruction of the socialist system. No matter what they say, it's not to be taken seriously. I mean, the only kind of deal that they will accept is the kind of deal that Mikhail Gorbachev gave them in 1989, which is a deliberate collapse of socialism. I think that that's clearly very well established now, and it's actually, I think, a positive thing that the government of the DPRK has recognised that.
Yes, it is very positive, and it's an affirmation of their belief in socialism and their desire and intention to maintain socialism. It's a real big slap in the face to those who wanted to restore capitalism in the DPRK. And I think we should make this fact known to a wider audience.
An additional question about the South, if you don't mind responding to this, Dermot. The press recently covered, and this is indeed a story that was even featured in the bourgeois press, the desire of the government of Yoon Suk-yeol in the occupied South to extend the working day to 21 and a half hours, which is, of course, far beyond anything that you would find in the legal limiting of the working day in even our own country. And yet South Korea, which is portrayed as the bastion of freedom next to the so-called slave state or barrack socialism in the North, is the one going down this route. So I wondered if you could respond to that with what it tells us about the nature of the South Korean regime.
Well, I mean, that's truly horrendous. A 21-hour working day means people would only get 2 or 3 hours sleep. It's truly horrendous, but it's typical of South Korea, which already has the longest working hours in the world, has massive repression of the labor and trade unions in South Korea. And, you know, there's a totally false image of South Korea created by the mainstream media, or bourgeois media, if you like. You know, they portray it as some kind of liberal human rights paradise, when in fact it's a society with a big gap between the rich and the poor. There's long hours, there's poverty and exploitation, there's slums. I mean, it is basically a hell for the workers, basically.
Yes, and fitting with the character and the class content of those who formed the occupied South, such as Syngman Rhee and others, who I believe many of whom were prior to working as essentially caretakers for the South for U.S. imperialism, many of the founders of the South Korean state were actually collaborators with the Japanese, I believe.
Well, some of them were. I mean, Syngman Rhee was perhaps the exception, but his own record was very tainted. He was a bourgeois nationalist who married an Austrian woman and that she lived in Hawaii for a very long time. And he's, before 1945, his claim to fame was a very dubious one, that he actually embezzled the funds of the Korean independence movement. You know, he was very corrupt even before he got into power. And I believe an American journalist, Mark Gain, said that it was, you know, to paraphrase this, as I don't remember the exact quote, it was wrong to characterize Syngman Rhee as a fascist. He was really from an era before fascism, of, you know, two centuries before. You know, he was like a Bourbon absolutist, basically. However, many of the other original founders of South Korea were indeed Japanese collaborators, and Japanese collaborators were given high positions in South Korea. And a lot of the South Korean puppet rulers, like Park Chung-hee, for example, who ruled South Korea from 1961 to 1917, came to power for a military coup. He was a Japanese collaborator, as was Chun Doo-hwan, another military ruler. So, yes, people who were Japanese collaborators always played a big role in South Korean politics.
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, the one of the reasons that we have discussions on this channel with people like yourself is that this is something that should be better understood in the British labor movement, soaked as it is in, shall we say, apologetics for imperialism a lot of the time. And these things are never properly discussed. Another thing, Dermot, I wanted to take up with you, given that where we are at the moment, is, of course, the record of the DPRK in international solidarity. One of the things that the speech by Comrade Kim Jong-un makes clear, where he also talks about the relations with the occupied South, is that the priority of the DPRK government is, of course, firstly, building good relations with socialist countries, but then also building positive relations with all those who seek an independent and sovereign path to development. I think that's very important, given that I think that that's something which is going to actually make more people who are seeking that course of development actually look positively upon the DPRK, given that even according to our own beloved former Prime Minister John Major, it's actually the most sovereign state in the world. And given that the word of the moment in sort of oppositionist circles is sovereignty, it seems that the model of the DPRK and the lessons the DPRK can teach should be something that developing nations are paying more attention to, don't you think?
Yes, I think the DPRK is like a shining beacon of independence and socialism, and a real example to the peoples of the third world. You know, it's an example that you know, people should be copying in different Asian and African and Latin American countries. You know, they should become independent and self-reliant like the DPRK, and should build independent national economies, reject imperialism, take a firm anti-imperialist line. And he, in his both the speech to the Ninth Plenum of the CC of the WPK and the speech to the Supreme People's Assembly, respected Marshal Kim Jong-un called for the DPRK to sort of step up the struggle against US imperialism, both internally and externally, and to take initiatives on the international stage. And of course, recently, the DPRK vice foreign minister attended a summit meeting of the non-alignment movement, which I think is quite important. And I think in the coming year, we will see more DPRK initiatives to step up the struggle against the US-led world imperialism.
Yes, and I think this is another point that needs to be understood in the labour movement in Britain and the workers' movement across the imperialist countries as well, which is that the system that we live under, which is, of course, the imperialist system, no matter what its politicians say, in the case of the DPRK proves this, only complete submission and surrender is going to be acceptable to imperialism, because imperialism, by its very nature, has to subordinate as many countries and peoples as possible in order that they can be hyper-exploited, that their resources can be looted, that they as workers can be hyper-exploited. And the system that we live under, that of decaying imperialism now, needs this more than ever because of it is running into more and more problems, which is why they're getting so desperate and hostile towards the DPRK, but also towards much larger countries such as the Chinese and the Russians as well. So I think that the lesson that needs to be learned, and I want to get your take on this in the workers' movement here, is that we need to make sure that the working class in Britain understands the nature of the system that we live under, and therefore understands that it doesn't matter what the resident occupant of number 10 Downing Street says about, you know, peace and international cooperation. The mere fact that he is the head of British imperialism means that an unremittingly hostile policy is always going to be pursued, whether it's Labour or Conservative in office.
Yes, I think that's very true. It doesn't matter who is in Downing Street. British imperialism continues, and also the subordinate relationship to US imperialism, the so-called special relationship, will continue. And certainly, with the experience of the DPRK, although diplomatic relations between the DPRK and Britain were opened about 23 years ago, and this was seen as a victory at the time, in fact, the hostile policy of the UK towards the DPRK has continued. The UK has imposed its own sanctions on the DPRK. They've been unremittingly hostile to the DPRK. They've carried out massive propaganda against the DPRK and so on. It's been very, very bad. It is the case that British imperialism and US imperialism will always be hostile to the DPRK and will always try to overthrow the socialist system there.
And just to conclude the discussion on a point about anti-imperialism, Dermot, the protests that have been going around at the moment with regard to the protests against the actions of the Israelis in carrying out this sort of mass murder operation that they've been doing in Gaza and in the West Bank as well. I think it's worth emphasizing, Dermot, that the DPRK has been in complete solidarity with the Movement for Palestinian National Liberation from the very earliest point. And I think I'm right in saying that they don't even diplomatically recognize the Israeli regime. And this is a pretty much almost an unrivaled record, isn't it, in terms of in terms of showing solidarity with the Palestinians as a as an oppressed nation, and never even opening up relations with the Israeli state, which is just another US puppet regime after all.
Yes, that's certainly very true. The DPRK has never at any point in its history had diplomatic relations with Israel, with the Zionist entity. They've never recognised Israel. In that sense, they've done a lot better than even some Arab countries like the, I think, United Arab Emirates and a few others, which have recognized Israel. And in fact, I would also mention here that the Israeli Zionists have been unremittingly hostile to the DPRK from quite early on. You know, there's the myth of Israeli socialism and socialist Zionism. But even in the 1950s, the Israeli Ben-Gurion, the Israeli premier, wanted to send Israeli troops to fight against the Korean people in the Fatherland Liberation War, or Korean War as it is known. In the end, they had to just send you know, funds to Israel rather than troops. And Israel's been funding so-called centers for so-called defectors from the DPRK South Korea. So, yeah, I mean, the Zionists are very anti-DPRK. And DPRK's always had good relations with different Palestinian movements. It's always been a close friend of the Palestine Liberation Organization. President Kim Il-sung met Chairman Yasser Arafat several times. The DPRK recognized Palestine back in 1966. You know, they've also assisted the anti-imperialist, anti-Zionist Arab countries on a number of occasions, such as the 1973 October War, when the planes of the Korean People's Army Air Force actually fought on the side of the Arab people and took part in operations against the Israelis. And they also deployed some planes of the DPRK on the Syrian front. And I'd also mention that the DPRK's had relations with both the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And in fact, when I've been in the DPRK, when I've been in the International Friendship Exhibition in Mount Moyhung, which houses the gifts sent from different countries to the great leaders of Korea, I actually came across a gift from the Juche Idea Study Group of the Popular Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is now the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. But, I mean, that shows that the Palestinian revolutionaries are studying the Juche Idea. And one last point I would mention is that Chairman Kim Jong-il actually adopted a Palestinian child, and she's now an adult, and she heads a special foundation. She's a doctor, but you know, I think this shows that the DPRK has got very close relations with Palestine and extends a lot of solidarity to Palestine.
Yes, and it's an excellent example of anti-imperialist solidarity in action there, Dermot, what you've been talking about there. Just to conclude, I'll give you an opportunity to talk about the work of the Korean Friendship Association and where people can find you online and how people can find out more about the KFA and what you're doing.
Right. Well, we in the Korean Friendship Association with the UK, our slogan is to defend people's Korea with no ifs or buts. And you know, we strongly defend the socialist system of the DPRK and the DPRK's independence. We carry out different activities. We've got a number of events, both in real life and online, planned in the coming months. We've just held an annual general meeting at which we decided to step up activity and hold different events, possibly to picket the US and South Korean embassies again, possibly to picket the BBC. You can find us in a number of places online. We've got a Telegram channel. We've got several YouTube channels. There's my personal channel, Songam007, which is easy to find, but there's also a Korean Friendship Association of the UK channel as well. We're on Twitter. We've got over 8,000 followers on Twitter. Again, we're easy to find on Twitter. And yes, we're still on Facebook. You know, they took down the Facebook page last year, but we set up another one, but it's early days, still trying to build it up. So that's where you can find us.
All right, excellent. And I particularly recommend the KFA Telegram channel, and everybody goes and follows that. It's a very good source of up-to-the-moment information and historical detail that's very useful for comrades to check out. So, Dr. Dermot Hudson of the Korean Friendship Association, thank you for joining us today. And we hope to have you back when there's more to discuss, as there always is, with regard to the DPRK and the local and global situation.
Thank you very much for interviewing me. It's been a great pleasure. Have a good day. Yeah.